can't remember the details of our first Christmas, but something stand out. A few weeks before Christmas, a Chinese came up to me and said that he always decorates the chapel every Christmas for his former chaplain. He said he'd do a good job, and he quoted the price like $100. I thought it was $100 wasted, you know. And he pushed and presented a case, and I checked with some other people and found that he really decorated the chapel, and so I couldn't figure out how he could put $100 into it. I thought I was really being taken. But I was...
You ready for dinner?
So I told him, go ahead. And man, you wouldn't believe what he did to that whole inside of the chapel. I think every inch of the wall was covered. He had all kinds of colored paper. It looked like a million Christmas cards of all kinds of flashy colors. They're all, you know, all in keeping with Christmas. And he had Christmas trees up, and he had lights, and it was really splashy. It almost looked more like a Christmas carnival. But I think it added to the atmosphere. At least people knew it was Christmas. I don't remember whether we used his services a second year or not. At any rate, we had a very good Christmas program. Of course, we had a morning worship service, and we had a afternoon or evening service where kids and everyone would say their pieces, and we had a skit put on by the Sunday school of all ages, which Mom had written, Lois had written, and a lot of good music and chorus singing, and we had goodies that we handed out to all the kids, and it was a very good Christmas program. Once in a while, we'd have guests come out to chapel. We'd have people from Far Eastern Gosford Crusade that would come through town, and I'd always get them to do something. Norman Nelson, a very outstanding singer. I think he was worked as missionary in the Philippines under Orient Crusades. It wasn't Far Eastern Gosford Crusades. It was the Orient Crusades. Now, I think they call it the Overseas Missionary Fellowship or Overseas Crusades, I'm forgetting. And he would stop by and sing, and this was always outstanding. He was known around the world as Norman Nelson. We became friends. They always welcomed him. And Bud Schaefer, Norm Cook, these people would be coming to Kaohsiung, and Morrison Academy. Some occasionally would have their choir out, and of course we'd use them. I remember one time we had a program all set up and the bulletins all printed. We always had bulletins every Sunday, order of service, a little bit of news, and all of a sudden appeared the Morrison Academy choir, and they're very good, these kids, high school. And I don't know if we could use them. And I said, boy, can we use you? So we just dovetailed them in, and everyone enjoyed it. We had a few missionaries that didn't have services on Sundays, and they would participate. They'd come to church there, and that would be their chapel. They wouldn't necessarily speak. Often they'd like to have a day off as they were teaching the Bible school. The assistant chaplain was J. Hudson Taylor, the third or fourth, I forget, an elderly gentleman. I think it was probably the third, the grandson of famous founder of the China Mission. And he had held the title of assistant chaplain for several years. He didn't do any assisting either. It was an honorary thing. But it was an honor to become associated with him and get to know him. And I think he had diabetes or something, so as assistant chaplain gave him the privilege of using the PX in the commissary, and he could get foods that he needed and medications. I got to go out to his mission, which was on the outskirts of the town, and he was Free Methodist. He was no longer with the Chinatown Mission. His son, right now, is head of the Chinatown Mission. And again, they've changed the name of it. And I can't keep up with all these name changes of the missions. But I got to know his son, Jim Taylor, which I think was about J. Hudson Taylor III, then, or fourth, rather. And he had a little boy, and I asked him one day what Jimmy's name was. He said J. Hudson Taylor V, I think. And I asked Jim Taylor if he went out as a missionary because of his family and his tradition. He said, no, he fought it. He really said, I wasn't going to do this at all. I didn't want to be a missionary, but he felt that over a period of time that God had called him. I knew him a few months, and then he went back to Yale University to get his PhD in Far Eastern languages, and I haven't had any contact with him since. But they're good people, humble people, live very modestly, as many of the Free Methodist people do. And they had a school, they had a little Bible college and seminary. They did a good job, and I saw their facilities were very simple and humble. They had classes and buildings that were more shacks than anything, but they turned out good preachers, and they had good education to their students with spending minimum of money. One time, long as I'm on the Taylors, they had a Methodist dignitary on Taiwan. His name was E. Stanley Jones. And he wrote a little booklet called Abundant Living that was very famous when I was a teenager. And he was probably the most famous Methodist of his day, E. Stanley Jones. And
he wrote a lot of books, right?
Yeah, I guess he wrote a lot of books, didn't he? Reverend Taylor, Dr. Taylor, asked me if I would mind providing transportation for East Stanley Jones, because Taylor didn't have a car, and I said, I'd be glad to. So I got a carry-all, I think I used my own car, because I was driving. If I had a military car, I had to use a Chinese driver. So I had the privilege of meeting East Stanley Jones. And we're sitting three in the front seat, and I thought that these two people, were fully acquainted, but they had just met. And I chatted a little with E. Stanley Jones, and Dr. Taylor, the senior Taylor, had to leave my car for a bit, and he said, "Who is this Dr. Taylor?" And I said, "You don't know." And he said, "No." I said, "You just met Dr. J. Hudson Taylor, the grandson of the founder of Chinatown Mission." And so it was one very important man in Christian circles meeting another. And I thought I had something to do with that. I had the opportunity of telling E. Stanley Jones that long before that, when I was a young Marine stationed in North China in Shantung University, that's where we lived, in the classrooms, that a friend of mine had discovered a small library that was in one of the classrooms. And this library was owned by a Japanese officer. The Japanese also used the university as a place to live, a billet. And this Japanese officer undoubtedly was Christian, because the library had a lot of Christian books in it. You don't think of the Japanese officers and soldiers as being Christian, but there were some. And One of the books that he discovered was Abundant Living by E. Stanley Jones. And this enlisted friend of mine, he asked me if I would like to have that. He kept a lot of books himself because he was a Christian Marine. And I said I'd be very delighted to have a copy of E. Stanley Jones. And Dr. Jones was very fascinated that a Japanese officer had had one of his books through the war. I still have this book in my possession someplace around here. I don't think I had him sign it or anything because it wasn't convenient at that time. So I escorted Dr. Jones and Dr. Taylor around and things they had to do in the city and the speaking engagements, and it was just a little fun thing. I just happen to remember now. I probably haven't thought of it in 10 years or more. I had a hard time doing things like accepting speaking engagement. I often get invitation by missionaries and others to speak, and I felt that I should do that if it didn't conflict with my military obligations. But I found that my immediate commanders just were not favorably disposed to giving permission to do that sort of thing. I had a Marine major, he was a nice guy, Russell, but he just felt that I was supposed to serve the military. I said, well, PR is important too, and chaplain can develop a lot of public relations with missions that wouldn't hurt the American military at all. Paragraph. I did speak at two conferences by the Orient Crusades as a main speaker, but I had many other invitations and I had to turn them down, unfortunately. Also, even though I had a lot of free time on the book, leave time, they just wouldn't let you take it. We did have one R&R to Hong Kong. Doris and I, we can talk about that when we get through with dinner tonight. But I wanted to go to a lot of other places. I've been invited by the Navy attaché to go to Bangkok, and because he'd been one of the captains on one of our destroyers. His name was Captain Carroll. And I wanted, like everything, Doris and me to go to Bangkok, and he would have really treated us royally because we were good friends. But I couldn't get permission. There's no reason for it, really, because I had the time coming, but I always felt that the Navy was pretty hard on its chaplains. Generally, they treated us well, but we were either God or the devil. We were nothing in between. Either they treated us like we're God or else they hated us. And generally speaking, I was treated well, but I felt that I deserved a little free time. For instance, not getting any days off, and as far as I can remember, in 2 years, working 7 days a week, which really wore me down. One of the things that a person has to do as a military chaplain is to cooperate with people of other denominations or churches. This doesn't necessarily mean that one waters down his own faith, his own religious convictions, but it simply means that where you can cooperate, you do cooperate. And in some cases, you will work with chaplains that are not even of a Christian faith. There are not very many of them, because most people in the United States and also military, I at least identify with some Christian faith. But nevertheless, there are things that you can cooperate on. For instance, welfare issues or moral issues. Navy Relief, Red Cross, quite a number of things that we have in common. Now, the largest religious group, of course, involved the Catholic Church. And from the time I first started chaplain school, I met a number of young priests and got to know them personally, and many of them became good friends of mine. Other than Protestant, yeah, the largest religious group other than Protestant are the Catholics, Catholic priests. One discovers that you just have a lot in common as far as a person's goals are concerned, and even as far as a person's convictions are concerned. And you don't try to accentuate the one's differences with ministers of other beliefs, but rather you realize what things you have in common, and you start from there, and you learn to appreciate each other. On Taiwan, I was the only Navy chaplain on the island for perhaps the first year. And I was the only chaplain at all in the southern end of the island, Kaohsiung Soying. So I had to provide for other religious groups as well the best I could. That didn't mean I conducted services or anything like that. But it simply meant that I had to make sure that they had clergymen that would provide for their religious needs. One of the first things I did was to contact the Catholic Mission. And there were perhaps six or eight or more priests in the Catholic Mission. Half of them probably were American, and the others were from other countries, like perhaps Germany. I know there were one or two Spanish priests there too. And I felt that I learned that they appreciated my friendship toward them. Sorry for the interruption of that phone call. When we were in Taiwan, I was closely associated with the Catholic Mission. I found them very helpful. And they would conduct mass for the Catholic personnel, and they had Bible study, or actually religious instruction for the Catholic dependent kids from the military. They would do counseling for the Catholic personnel, and I arranged for them to get paid for this. And so we had we appointed one of these priests as assistant chaplain. I'm not sure if it was the head priest, the older priest there, Father Smith, or was Father Hickey. At any rate, even though one was appointed the assistant chaplain, sort of assistant to me, of course they wouldn't take orders from me or anything, but nevertheless, this would allow them to get paid for what time they used for the military personnel. The pay was rather well, it was rather good. But we would get the benefit of all the priests, because they would just sort of share the responsibilities. And also, this gave them PX privileges and commissary privileges, and this helped Father Smith a lot because he was a diabetic, so now he could get medical supplies and the type of food he needed. And the money that they received for their services, they could, was in American money, so they could spend it in the PX. So it was a mutual nice thing. One day, one of the priests, I think it was Father Hickey, stopped by my office, and he seemed to be rather chagrined, and he a little bit embarrassed, and he said, "You know," he said, "we priests, we like a little alcohol once in a while, a little nip of something to kind of ease the monotony," or however he put it. And he said, "All we can do is, the only thing to get a hold of is this cheap Taiwan liquor." And I had already kidded and joked with them about being wine bibbers. So I just smiled, and I said, "Well, I'll see what I can do." So since they were serving the military, I was able to get them a card, a permit to buy alcoholic beverages. And they thought that this was one of the most wonderful things in the world. It kind of amused me because I don't drink, and I didn't judge them for drinking. They have different philosophy about those things, and I don't think any of them would ever drink to excess. But that's one of those little incidents that I remember. But it sort of cemented our relationship a little bit more. The priests, well, we had our youth organization, the Tri-C Club. We had a few Catholics coming, and a lot of the other Catholic kids wanted to come too because we had so many activities. So I talked to Father Smith as a senior priest, and asked him if he would mind if the Catholic kids become part of our Tri-C Club. And without any hesitation, he said, "No, that would be all right." At any rate, without any hesitation, Father Smith said, "Yes, they could attend our parties and even our meetings in the chapel on Sunday afternoons." And I assured him that we would just have simple Bible stories and film strips and things of that nature, which would not be offensive to the Catholic Church. He didn't require me to give him that assurance, but I did, which I thought was very kind on him. But we tried to coordinate all of our activities, and we had much in common, working with the military community, trying to help them one way or another, keep the kids out of trouble, keep the enlisted men out of trouble, and so together, I think we made a good team. One time we had a dinner at the officers' club that we invited the priests, and about eight of them that came, gave them dinner just to discuss local problems. Another time, one of the priests had died, an elderly Spanish priest, and I was able to provide them with a military vehicle so they could take care of all the details and things of that nature. One of the people I met there was, got to know, was a nun, Sister Hilda, who had a girls' school, and she was actually a surgeon, a medical doctor. And she was an elderly lady, and very dedicated. And she was partly lame, and she would cover all of her little clinics. And she didn't have any vehicles or anything, so she'd use pedicabs, ride in a pedicab, and then walk sometimes great distances in order to take care of sick people. I admired her, Sister Hilda, very much. She was very well known because of her humanitarian efforts. every once in a while she would call on me for something. We've had a lot of interruptions, phone calls and people stopping by and things like that, so it's kind of hard to pick things up where we left them off. I was talking about the Sister Hilda, this elderly nun. She had a great sense of humor and we hit it off real well. Sometimes she'd call me when she wanted medical supplies. One time she wanted 75 beds. And I asked her, where in the world I'd get 75 beds? So she said, well, that's not for her to say where I'm going to get them, but she needed them. So I realized it was for the clinics. So I took and sent a wire off to Chaplain, Navy Chaplain I knew on Guam, and I realized that they had a lot of supplies stored there, and the Navy just soon get rid of them because they took up space. And so I asked if they could supply 75 beds, and they said they could, regular Navy single beds, steel. So they sent me 100 beds. And so the beds came in on a Navy ship, and we gave them to Sister Hilda, and then the extra beds we gave to another missionary doctor, Dr. Bjorgis, who was, I'm not sure if he's Danish or Norwegian. At any rate, the beds didn't have any mattresses, so I mentioned it to the head of the Marine Advisory Group, Colonel Angus Frazier. Colonel Frazier had been in Okinawa when I was there, and he'd been in Qingdao, China, when I was there, but I didn't know him. And we became good friends, and he and his wife and Doris became good friends. And so at any rate, I just mentioned to him, I wonder what in the world she's going to do without mattresses. And he said, oh, he'd fix that up. So he sent the wire off to the commanding officer of a Marine air base in Japan. And the Navy flew in 100 Navy mattresses and donated. And I said, well, that cost the Navy a lot of money to fly them. And he said, well, not necessarily, because these airmen have to put in flying time. And they might as well fly to Taiwan with mattresses as they were doing, as well as do anything else. I should tell you a little bit about Colonel Frazier if I remember. Well, then we sort of got the idea of supplying medical equipment and medicines to missionaries. There was a tremendous need among the missionaries throughout Taiwan for medical supplies, just everything and anything. And they would ask me occasionally if I could give them this, that, or the other thing, and I'd try to get these supplies. So then I decided to go at it more systematically. I did a little research and got a list of all the missionary organizations on Taiwan that had clinics or hospitals. And I discovered there are a lot of them. They're doing a really fine work. But all of them were short of supplies. They couldn't afford it. And for one reason or another, they didn't have even adequate medication equipment. So then I sent a letter to all of them and asked them to give me a description of their mission, what organization they were affiliated with, where they're located, size, all kinds of details about their particular medical facilities, and then draw a little map how to find them. Then I asked them to tell me what they needed in medical supplies. Of course, I got real good response. Then I took this list of medical supplies and the missions, and I made up a little brochure. Started at, maybe 10, 15 pages, and by the time I left Taiwan, it was quite a thick little booklet. A lot of the sheets were about notebooks, paper size. And I would send lists of needed supplies to all the Navy, American Navy commanders that were coming into Taiwan. I'd always know ahead of time the ships that were coming in, well, maybe 2-3 months before they would arrive. Yeah, list. It'd be the organizations and what they needed medically and so on. And so these supplies start coming in, and I had a friend of mine who had his office in the same building as I did in Kaohsiung. And he was a reporter for Stars and Stripes, which was a military newspaper that covered the whole Orient, and they covered the news of the military in the whole Orient. So he would take pictures. We're talking about the conspiracy that we had in collaborating. The reporter from Stars and Stripes and myself. These military or Navy commanders would come in with medical supplies, and they'd always be supplies that were out of date. And I'm not sure where they got them all. They probably picked them up in military supply warehouse, they call it. I think they call them dumps, so they're not dumps, they're simply supplies. And they find out-of-date medicines, medications, and the equipment no longer being used by the military, and I don't know, but perhaps it's easier to give this stuff away than throw it away. At any rate, they would bring in and they'd have it piled on the ship on the deck or in front of the ship with the name of the ship there and the captain, and he'd get full Stars and Stripes coverage on the front page, and depending on how much supplies he gave, and he'd say, well, such and such a ship with Captain so-and-so would, and the sailors donated $10,000 worth of medical supplies. Well, it was probably worth $10,000 retail before it was outdated, but it looked good. And these military or Navy captains, they really like that publicity. So the word got around, and so the supplies start coming in, and we actually got tons of it in over a period of time. And we'd distribute it according to need. Sometimes the captain would specify where he wanted to go, and if not, we would try to figure out where to send it. Actually, the missions and the missionaries would usually pick it up. We didn't have to worry about transporting it. They would find some way of picking up the supplies, and often supply that we didn't even have to handle it. They would make a direct contact. They'd tell the mission when the ship was coming in or when the supplies were available, and we couldn't give them dates of ship movements, but at any rate. No, I can't remember his name. Mm-hmm. But he kind of got a kick out of the little conspiracy we had, if that's what it is. We would give these captains publicity, and as a result, we got just a lot of supplies. One of the outstanding medical missionaries, I mentioned his name before, Dr. Georgis, who's Scandinavian. D-J-O-R-G-A-S, I think. G-A-S, I believe. And he had a clinic in right near an air base, Tainan Air Base. I think the largest Air Force, Chinese Air Force base in Taiwan. And apparently there used to be a large American contingent there, but there was just a very few American servicemen there. There was a lieutenant colonel there. And on my circuit, I'd stop by and see him perhaps once a month, see if there's anything he needed, spiritual nature, that is, his men. And ultimately, I was able to appoint a missionary who was free on Sundays, Reverend Phillips, relative, a young Southern Baptist missionary, who very excellent, wonderful man. And he would serve that community. Of course, they paid for it, and he'd get PX privileges and so on, commissary, but he also was able to serve the Air Force base. I really couldn't get there myself. Pardon? No, this is Reverend Phillips who did a Southern Baptist missionary. At any rate, I kind of got sidetracked. This was in the city of, right outside of the city of Tainan in southern Taiwan, this big Air Force base. And Dr. Bjorgis had his clinic there. And his clinic was really an old, large house. It was not Oriental style. It was more European style house. I have no idea why it was built, who it belonged to originally. And it was not in too good condition. But his specialty was children and conducting surgery on children who had deformities in bones and things of that nature. I'm not too sure what label you give him as a doctor. But he had this house filled with kids who, and he tried to take care of their deformities, Chinese kids. And he would also keep them and turn into an orphanage, too. Because the Chinese do not like deformed people or deformed children. And they would, they'd assume they didn't exist, and they would kind of ignore them, even though they're their own children, and treat them, if not cruelly, at least ignore them, and it was a rather pathetic sight. And kind of remind me of an animal, if it has a deformed young, they would kind of push it out of the litter. Perhaps in Chinese, if they could hear me say this, would feel offended, but that's the way it was. Of course, a lot of supplies were channeled into Dr. Bjorgis, and a lot of money. The Air Force had done a great deal for him. And I managed to make a lot of contacts in the Navy. Well, finally, 2 months before I left, Dr. Bjorgis had gathered together enough money from abroad and from military sources on the island and maybe just a lot of places, and build a paraplegic hospital for children. I don't remember how many stories, perhaps 3-4 stories high, and I don't remember how many beds. And I visited the hospital and because I checked and see what needs he had. So they had the dedication of the hospital, and he asked me to give the dedicatory address. He said I had done more than any other one person on the island at that time for his hospital and getting supplies and so on, so he wanted to honor me by asking me to give a speech for dedication. So I did, and it was translated from English by a Chinese Air Force colonel, from English into Chinese. It was a big occasion, a lot of Chinese and American dignitaries at the hospital. Anyways, this was a rather nice experience. I didn't realize I had done that much, but maybe just a lot of contacts were made by sending out my brochure to the ships, and a lot of the captains have responded by sending supplies to him directly and money and so on. Now, I'm not saying I'm going to build a hospital. I'm certainly not. Maybe what came from me is relatively small amount, but that's one of the stories. Dr. Jorgens was a marvelous man, and he would give the kids food and give them back their self-respect, and he had a school for them, and if the Chinese parents didn't want to or couldn't accept their children back again, well, he would keep them there, raise them, and I hear a lot of kids who had physical disabilities got a chance at life, and probably because of the food and training and Christian training, they're brought to the Lord, and education, they probably were better prepared for life than maybe the average Chinese kid or Taiwanese kid on the island. He worked mostly with the Taiwanese kid rather than the Chinese. The Chinese were attached more or less to the military. Maybe some retired or some were dependents. And the Chinese military would pretty well take care of their own as much as they could, but the Taiwanese didn't have anyone to take care of them. There's a big difference between the Chinese and Taiwanese. The Taiwanese often were had a lot of Japanese blood in them, because the Japanese had ruled the island for so long that maybe their half bottom were like half Japanese. This made the Taiwanese. There were a lot of Taiwanese out in the country who were isolated from the Japanese, and they maintained their distinctive southern Chinese characteristics. Hope I'm making this clear. I'm sort of rattling on. And one time I was outside of our chapel in Kaohsiung, and was still involved with Dr. Bjorges. And I saw a girl there who probably was 8 or 10 years old. She was little and skinny for her age, and she had dirty, raggy clothes on. She was Taiwanese. And she had a knee joint that would swing both ways. She'd put pressure on the knee and her leg, and it just wouldn't just support her. So she had a crutch, but the crutch was made out of a tree branch, where it was cut in such a way that the top part looked like a crutch and the bottom would support her. That's why she hobbled along. And I went up and tried to use my poor Chinese on her, and she became frightened, and she ran away like a scared puppy. And it was a very pathetic sight. She was just very frightened of me. And the way she acted, just put one arm up as though she thought I was going to hit her or something. So I went to the Chinese custodian of a chapel, KCC we call it, and it's meant Kaohsiung Community Center. They use it for other things, but mainly chapel. And I went to the custodian, who's Chinese, and I asked him to find out where the girl lived. And he said he understood and everything. I went back to him a few days later and asked him for that information. He said, "Oh, everything all right," in Chinese. But my Chinese apparently was so bad, and he misunderstood me, and I was getting across. So then I asked Doris to talk to him in Chinese. And he said, "Oh, it's all right. She won't come back and bother you anymore." So very typically, if there's someone who is deformed, is sort of a disgrace, they don't want to look at them, they ignore them and turn their back on them. And he naturally thought that I just didn't want such a horrible-looking creature around the chapel, and he chased her away. So Doris explained, "No, we want to know where she lived." And then he couldn't understand why we would want to know where she lived. That was beyond him. He's a very fine gentleman. In fact, he was supposedly a Chinese Christian. I think he was. But he was immersed in the culture there. So, in the meantime, I talked to Dr. Georges and asked if he would, if there's anything he could do for the girl. He said, well, he would go talk to the parents. So we made the contact, and he talked to the parents, and he made arrangements to take the girl. And they actually turned over the girl to him. After that, that girl belonged to Dr. Georges, and they were glad to get rid of her. In a case like that, the girl couldn't even sit and eat with the other children, and the child would only eat leftovers. And they treated just like a lame dog, you know. And can you imagine what that would do to the child's self-image? And I don't know whether this girl could ever be salvaged. But Dr. Bjorgis took her into his hospital and performed surgery on her, and occasionally I asked about her, and so her knee was made normal, so she could use it normally, and he said in time the muscles would develop, and he's giving her therapy, and not only physiotherapy, but therapy for her emotional deformity. And he said, oh, she'll work out all right, and he's going to enroll her in their school. And I asked him, well, how much would that cost per month? He said, well, the surgery and the medical, that's free. He said, it costs about $10 a month, I think, or something like that. I forget. His supporter. And I said, well, the chapel can take that on. They can afford that. So at any rate, this was the sort of thing that Dr. Georges did. This is only one example, but there were hundreds of examples of the great work he did. And I was told he was one of the finest surgeons for, they call it orthopedic, you know, for doing this sort of thing in the Far East. And he's probably about, I don't know, 40 years old, 38, 42, I don't know, relatively young. And he could go any place in the world and make just an awful lot of money, but here he's out doing this free for his Chinese kids, Taiwanese kids. See some very great people when you're out like that, and they don't try to be important, and no one knows what they're doing except in God. I don't think they're completely aware of the great work they're doing themselves. Dr. Georges also had some leprosy clinics, and we get supplies. I visit these clinics occasionally. Mainly just to catch him. He's a hard person to catch, and see what supplies he needed, or he had business to transact relative to his medical work. And these people, he'd have to go out and find the Chinese and Taiwanese who had leprosy, because this was a disgrace, and the people would hide the family members. No one would ever see them, and they'd just rot away with their leprosy. And if you ask who has leprosy in, you know, in the community, no one would say anything. Even if they knew, they wouldn't say who had leprosy. So he had to convince these people that they could be helped and that it was not a dishonor to have leprosy. And some of these people came from wealthy homes, and they'd be wealthy people, but they were disgraced because they had leprosy. Reminds one of the healing for lepers in biblical times. And I would go into these in the clinic and be sure that it was safe, and he'd be treating people, and they'd be waiting, like in a doctor's waiting room, although it would be a rather simple building, almost a shack, as he had these clinics scattered around. I'd put the clinics where the people were at. And you'd see people without toes and fingers and noses and things like that. But once he got them, he could kill them. It's just a matter of getting them before they get too deformed, but he could always kill them. One day I saw a lady that her stubbed toes were bleeding. It was kind of gross. And I said, I thought you told me that leprosy doesn't bleed. He said, well, he told me that there's no pain to it, and there's no bleeding. And I said, how come that lady's toes are bleeding? He said, well, once you're sleeping at night, the rats would come along and chew off the leper's flesh. And it just sets your stomach just to think about it. So you'd have to put some protection on that. But he said that you cure the leprosy, but we can't change what's already damage already done. Well, then whenever they come, they would have a Bible lesson. And so many of these lepers, deformed as they were Christians. They knew the Lord. But all of them were required to listen to a story about the gospel. And, so all of his medical work was tied into evangelism. Now, he didn't always do the teaching and preaching. He usually used Chinese pastors and Christian workers to do that, because he was so busy taking care of the medical aspect. And besides, Chinese Christians could deal with them in their own culture and their own language. Plus, I met many other people, medical people, that were doing very fine work to send some supplies up to Mrs. Dixon, who's world famous, she and her husband. And Dixon was her name. I can't remember her first name anymore. But she had a well-established organization, so it wasn't that we made a big dent in the work that she did. I think it was just Mrs. Dixon. I don't think her husband was living there then. I don't know. And I don't remember ever meeting her, but she found out about us, and we she'd asked us for supplies. Of course, we did what we could.
Okay.
I've spoken with Dr. Georgis, and I should mention Mrs. Georgis. I didn't get to know her well at all, and I would always deal with the man and the missionary. I think she was a registered nurse, and she had given years of sacrificial service taking care of these Chinese kids, many of them all dirty and diseased, and trying to nurse them back to health. Some you couldn't nurse back to health. I remember Dr. Georgis was saying that one of the most heartbreaking things was that he had to be selected. He only had so many beds and so much time and so much staff. And he'd see all these kids that needed surgery and medical attention. And he said he'd have to take the ones that he could most likely help. And he'd have to leave others just to remain where they're at, and knowing that many of them will die simply because he doesn't have room to take care of them. And he said that was the most heartbreaking part of his mission work, that he had to be selective and decide who's going to live and who's going to die among these kids. Imagine the tremendous burden of this godly man. I think he was Lutheran, I'm not sure. Met many other very fine godly people too. Close association with the Southern Baptists. The Southern Baptist, the senior missionary, wanted me to stay on Taiwan and join the Southern Baptist mission. And I was very much interested in that. I wasn't real happy with the Navy because of just a lot of reasons. I felt the Navy had treated me pretty well. But if I think of it, I'll go into my evaluation, the Navy's relative to a clergyman. But I really want to work among the Chinese and the Taiwanese. I'd love to stay there. So at any rate, this missionary recommended me to Southern Baptist Foreign Mission Board, and it so happened that the head of the Southern Baptist Mission Board was coming through Taiwan. He set up an interview, and our interview went well, but he said, the problem is this, that we have a rule, and I think this was the ruling, that you have to be a member of Southern Baptist Church for 2 years and have served in some type of ministerial capacity or youth director capacity for 1 year. may not be quite correct on that because it was many years ago. But he said that the World Council of Churches had a ministry going in Hong Kong for military, perhaps even commercial, seamen. And they had a service center, and they needed someone who was a clergyman who could go out on the ships and hold services, including American ships. And he said that he was in a position to make the appointment. If I would want that job, he would see that I would get appointed. It could be a lifetime job. I like Hong Kong. It was tempting. But I'd be a stranger in a strange country and working with foreigners. Now, if I had something like that where I worked with the Chinese, it would have been a different situation. And I didn't think I'd want to be put on Hong Kong. And I wasn't sure about schooling for our children and just a number of things. It probably presented many opportunities. I'm sure the pay was well, it was good, and there's opportunity for travel and for leave and educational allowances for the children, and it might have been a very fine opportunity. But, I did right or wrong, and said no. Mentioned Southern Baptist, one interesting incident, and it kind of shows a little bit more about the Taiwanese culture and things that go on. One day, Sister Hilda came to me, and didn't come to me directly, but she sent a letter over to me. And this letter was received by American Navy Chief Pelloy Petty Officer from Japan. He was a postal chief. He was in the American Post Office in Japan. Military Post Office. And he was afraid that he was going to get in trouble with the military. And what happened was that he'd been stationed on Taiwan for a few years. He had more than his 2 years tour of duty there. He was probably there at least 4 years or more. And he had his wife and children, don't remember how many, with him on Taiwan. But he also had a Taiwanese girlfriend. And when his wife found out about the girlfriend, she left him and took off for home and ultimately divorced him. So the wife could not take the household effects with her back to the States because you could only do that if he had orders. So here he had an apartment and a Chinese house or whatever it was, and a refrigerator and all the other equipment. And so he just moved his girlfriend in. Now this girlfriend was... She wasn't a bar girl. She wasn't a prostitute either, although they lived as man and wife. I think you probably, I don't remember what you call her, but she worked in a Chinese tea house. She would entertain, and she wasn't above having sexual relations with important sailors that would come in, American or otherwise, but she was considered well above a prostitute in their culture, as I understand it. But at any rate, when they started living together as man and wife, well then, of course, she stuck to him. I think he actually had to buy her from the madam, or whoever was responsible for her, because I don't think she owned her own soul, really, but I don't know exactly if that's completely true. She might have been old enough to have had her freedom, because I think they have to start in a tea house, but when they get to be a certain age, the government gives them their freedom. Apparently she's a very beautiful girl. I saw pictures of her. And, well, they lived together and they had a child, a little girl. And at the time I entered the picture, the girl was about the same age as our daughter, Carolyn, Cookie. And maybe Cookie was a year old. And so this Navy chief was transferred to Japan. And he told his mistress that he was going to send for her. He left her $1,000 and all the household effects, and I guess he felt he'd done right by her. But the problem was that she was in love with the sailor. And friends of his that I contacted told me how his letters got less and less frequent to his mistress, and finally she became more and more despondent. Money didn't come. Perhaps some came at first. And she would sell, like, a refrigerator and sell something else in order to make a living, and so on. And finally she'd get more and more despondent, and she, you know, came to the point she realized that she was never going to see the man that she loved. And so over a period of months, this went on. And so this... one day she took her little girl and went out to her mother's house, which is about a four-hour jeep ride from Kaohsiung, where my office is located, where Sister Hilda's hospital. I don't know if I told you that, but Sister Hilda also ran a hospital besides the girls' school. And